I'm Dan Rodericks, and you're listening to Midday. On most days over the last few weeks, the good economic news has outweighed the bad. But our next guest believes the long-term prognosis for the economy is grim, and that we'd better get ready for it. Richard Heinberg, a longtime prophet of oil-based doom, argues that humanity has reached a fundamental turning point in its economic history as a shaky world economy, already mired in debt, collides with non-negotiable limits on fossil fuels and natural resources. At the same time, the climate is changing in ways that we can't predict, and probably not for the better. The result? A stable and shrinking world economy that will challenge our ability to make more out of less. Richard Heinberg on the end of growth and the new normal, next on Midday, after the news. And welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. If you've heard the term peak oil, or maybe even peak everything, chances are you've heard or read something by our next guest. In fact, he was a guest on Midday 11 months ago for Power Ahead, our week-long series in 2011 on the nation's and the world's energy future. Richard Heinberg is the author of 10 books, most based on the assertion that we've reached and even passed the peak production of fossil fuels, such as oil and coal, not to mention our other natural resources that have enabled centuries of unprecedented growth. Richard Heinberg believes that, like everything, every other living organism, mankind has reached the limits of growth, and he says we'd be better prepared for some nasty shocks going forward, as well as for life in a world economy that's smaller, poorer, and demands more of us as individuals than today's. So if you're worried about the recession we've seen for the last 4 years, and you're looking for signs that life will soon be back to normal, Richard Heinberg will tell you that you're delusional. In his latest book, The End of Growth, he argues that the current economic downturn is not temporary because we've reached fundamental, non-negotiable limits. We have more debt than we can possibly repay. We're running out of the fossil fuels that have enabled unprecedented growth, and we're looking at the possibility of environmental changes and man-made ecological disasters that could tip the world into permanent depression at any time. Richard Heinberg explores the 2008 economic crisis as the perfect storm in his scenario and says that our money has come to represent claims on goods and services that just don't exist, and that as debt grows, the natural resources we can call on to repay it are rapidly being depleted. Innovation and gains in efficiency can no longer mask the underlying problems as they have in the past. On the bright side, he argues that we may not need constant growth to improve our lives, and that measurement like GDP, which economists have long relied on, aren't what we should really be looking for. He argues that we should be looking for alternative measurements, and we'll talk about some of them today. This is a provocative view of the world, folks, and we'll spend the rest of our hour talking with Richard Heinberg, a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute in California and author of, as I said, 10 books, including this latest one that's updated on his website, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. As I say, it's updated regularly at endofgrowth.com. So, Richard Heinberg, thanks again for joining us on Midday.
Well, thank you, Dan. Good to be with you.
Yep. For many years now, you know, you've been lecturing and writing about this subject of peak oil and the effects of an upcoming energy shortage. So I want you to just take a moment here and explain what peak oil really means now, why it's important now, and are we really on the downside of fossil fuel production?
Right. Well, a lot of times the peak oil scenario is mischaracterized as running out. We're not about to run out of oil or coal or natural gas. What's happening is we're applying the low-hanging fruit principle to resource extraction. What that means is we've harvested the cheapest, easiest to get, and highest quality resources first. So even though there's still lots of stuff we can turn into energy in the form of low-grade fossil fuels, with every passing year, we're having to drill deeper or dig deeper in terms of coal and produce lower quality stuff. And that has economic impacts. There's a relationship called energy return on energy invested. You know, it takes energy to get energy. And in the early days of the oil industry, for example, we had to invest a trivial amount of effort, about one barrel of oil's worth of energy, to get something like 100 barrels of oil out of the ground and to market. Today in the U.S., that ratio is closer to 20 to 1 and falling like a stone. And when you look at the more recent alternative sources like tar sands or shale oil like we're getting from North Dakota, the energy return on energy invested is in many cases 4 to 1, 5 to 1, 6 to 1 in that range. Well, actually, that's at such a low level that it's economically over the long term not capable of supporting the kind of industrial society we have. The only reason we're still able to do so is that most of our fossil fuels are still coming from oil reservoirs and coal mines that were discovered, you know, back in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, back in the heyday of the fossil fuel era. But as those deplete, as we pick those remaining low-hanging fruit, you know, what's left is simply not going to be able to sustain us economically.
Hmm. Now, someone listening to this would say, okay, I'll go with you on that. I understand about the easy oil, that we've already extracted all of that. And the oil, big oil keeps saying that they have plenty for the foreseeable future through shale and deep water drilling. But what about this, though? Haven't we always managed to innovate our way through these things? Couldn't we substitute one fuel or natural resource for another, or just grow in our efficiency as well as grow? Couldn't we just, couldn't all that combine to keep growth alive?
Well, you know, we will do all of those things, and I think there'll be important strategies for adapting to the end of growth. But the question you're asking is, will they be able to keep our economy growing? And I think the answer is probably not much longer. Efficiency, for example, is a very good thing when we're talking about energy efficiency, making our cars more energy efficient, our homes, and so on. Absolutely essential strategy for adaptation to more expensive and more scarce energy. But will energy efficiency on its own create growth? Well, I don't think so beyond a certain point, partly because of the law of diminishing returns. The first 5 or 10% gain in energy efficiency is usually really cheap and has a big payoff, economic payoff. But then the next 10 or 20%, it starts to get more expensive, and then the next 10 or 20% after that is so expensive, in many cases not even worth doing from a purely economic standpoint. So as we become more energy efficient, well, again, that's a good thing, but as we do so, we tend to exhaust our opportunities for further efficiency gains. You can't do anything without any energy expenditure. And a lot of the things we're doing right now with regard, especially with regard to communications, are approaching almost the thermodynamic limit in terms of the amount of energy we're spending in doing them. And transportation, you know, as we make our airplanes more efficient, our cars more efficient, we're going to be approaching that thermodynamic limit over the course of the next 10 or 20 years.
Hmm. So what you're saying is we're headed for this collision and we better prepare for it. This sort of a, well, it's not an ideology. I guess it is. It's an economic strategy, the growth strategy, economic growth. And you say we're in a collision course for the limits of the resources that can sustain it.
Right. Well, you know, we're accustomed to thinking of economic growth as being somehow natural and normal. If we're not seeing economic growth, there's something wrong.
Right.
But look at it historically, and almost all of this economic growth has occurred over a relatively short period of time. Go back for, let's say, 2,000 years, and that's a period during which we were seeing the rise and fall of empires, all kinds of historic events. And if you look at a chart of GDP per capita, there's nothing happening until the last 200 years. Once we found and started to use fossil fuels, which were cheap, abundant, highly concentrated, and in many cases portable energy sources, all kinds of things became possible. A lot of economists would say that energy is only part of the economy, but really energy is the economy. Without energy, nothing happens. And with cheap, abundant, portable energy, we could do amazing things, which we have done over the last couple of hundred years. We've created enormous amounts of new wealth, of economic growth. But there's really no reason to think that that will go on forever. You know, nothing grows forever on a finite planet. Think about a newborn hamster. It weighs very little, but it's growing very rapidly. It's doubling its body weight every week. Well, here's a little thought experiment. If that baby hamster were to continue doubling its body weight every week for one whole year, 52 doublings, how big a hamster would it be?
Well, it's a pretty big hamster.
Yeah, 50-pound hamster or 500-pound hamster.
Yeah.
Actually, it would be a 9 billion ton hamster. Of course, that, you know, it's never happened, never will happen. But, you know, that's what we're trying to do with the economy. We're trying to keep the economy doubling in size every few decades. And there are only so many doublings that you can accomplish on a finite planet with finite resources.
I run into this as a real life example. When I hear news reports on the radio or television or read in the newspaper about housing starts, that this was always considered in our country a measurement of economic vitality, economic growth. How many new houses are being built? And every time I heard that, I understand that there are home builders, there are people who build furniture that goes into homes, there are people who paint houses and put shingles on. There are all these people who are involved in this economy, the housing economy, of course, before there was a bust. But I used to wonder, is that how we measure growth? Is that how we measure quality of life, the number of new houses we build? Aren't we going to run out of space? Wouldn't it make you feel better to hear about the number of new housing renovations that are taking place, home improvement numbers? Do you know what I'm getting at here, Richard?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, what do we do once everybody has a house? Does growth stop then? Well, yeah, and basically that's what's happened over the last few years. You know, we had an enormous housing boom because we had a real estate price bubble. But we got to a point where there were actually plenty of houses for everybody, and that was the moment when the price went bust. Actually, there was more going on than that. In 2008, we also had an oil price spike up to almost $150 a barrel, and that actually interacted with the housing bubble, because it was in the suburban communities where people had long commutes that you know, they were filling up their SUVs, and it might cost $100 or more to fill the tank. And at the end of the month, people were finding they couldn't make their credit card payments and their mortgage payments. And it was in those communities where the housing bubble started to deflate first, and then things spread like wildfire throughout the rest of the market.
You know, I mean it almost as an aesthetic cultural thing, that this is a way we measure improvement. This is the way we measure economic growth. But we're also taking up more space. People are living further away from where they work, as you just said, in these suburbs and exurbs. And I just don't understand how that is used as a measurement. That can't be all there is to it.
Well, actually, we measure growth formally by way of GDP, or gross domestic product, which is just a number that represents how much money is spent in the economy on an annual basis. And GDP fundamentally is a marker for consumption. When consumption's going up, GDP is going up. When consumption's going down, typically GDP goes down as well. And we've been doing that really, again, only for a relatively short period of time since the end of World War II. That's when GDP became the metric that was adopted internationally to measure economic progress. So we have this single number on our dashboard that's telling us how we're doing. But, you know, GDP is, as many economists are now concluding, a perverse indicator, because there are a lot of bad things that can make GDP go up, like wars or recovery from natural disasters. So should we have more wars and natural disasters to keep the GDP up? Well, obviously no. But, you know, if you only have that one number to go by, it's pretty hard to make sound economic decisions from a social and environmental standpoint as well.
Richard Heimberg is a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute and author of this new book. Actually, it's published last August, but it's updated frequently on his website, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. If you have a comment or question for Richard Heidenberg during this hour, 410-662-8780 is our number. Toll-free long distance for midday on WYPR is 866-661-9309. Send a comment or question to email midday@wypr.org. I have a couple of emails to read when we get back. For more with Richard Heidenberg. Our guest in this hour of midday has been arguing for years that the peak production of oil and other fossil fuels is behind us and we should prepare for a grimmer economic future. He tells us how to prepare in this new book, The End of Growth, Richard Heidenberg, our guest. Richard, a couple of things I want to ask you about, and I have a couple of emails with some good questions for you here. The Wall Street Journal ran an article just a couple of weeks ago that said the U.S. is actually running out of places to store all the natural gas we've been pumping out of the ground, and the only thing that's holding back even more production is the low price. Natural gas has a lot of uses, you know, cooking, heating, producing electric power, too, and powering automobiles, maybe, and cars in the future. I mean, why can't we substitute gas for a lot of that oil, especially since, you know, the U.S. has claimed to be the Saudi Arabia of natural gas?
Right. Well, what we're seeing right now is interesting thing in the natural gas market, because we do have a glut, and it appears to be probably continuing for the next few years anyway. But where did that glut come from? Well, it came from very high natural gas prices a few years ago, as conventional natural gas was starting to dwindle and become more expensive. So the production industry decided to apply some technologies that had been developed actually for oil production, namely horizontal drilling and hydrofracturing, to produce natural gas from low porosity reservoirs. Well, they did this, but of course it's more expensive to use these new technologies. So it seemed to make sense when natural gas prices were up around $10, $14 a thousand cubic feet. But they let loose this temporary glut of supply, which has driven prices down to, I don't know, $2.40 a thousand cubic feet right now. And as a result, the producers are actually losing money on production. And they're continuing to produce only in cases where they need to maintain their leases or keep their share price up. But the result is going to be a shakeout in the industry. The drilling rates have fallen pretty dramatically in the last couple of years, simply because it doesn't make economic sense. So we probably in the next couple of years will start seeing declining natural gas production, and it's going to take a while for the market to settle out. So a lot of observers are looking at this, and they're assuming that the current glut in supply means that we can continue to have cheap and abundant natural gas for a very long time into the future. But if you take into account the very high decline rates in the wells and the higher cost in drilling, this new shale gas boom is probably not going to come to a very good end, and the longer range scenario is probably for lower rates of production and higher prices.
Richard, one of our listeners, Jeff, says that a while ago I read the book Twilight in the Desert, which suggested that the Saudi oil fields were in decline. This may be so, but is there real evidence that that's true? The Saudis appear to be able to make up for increased demand.
Yeah, there's good evidence that the Saudi oil fields are seeing annual declines in production that's being offset by new drilling. And I think anybody in the industry would tell you that's the case. Now, the question is, how much can they continue to drill those existing fields to maintain the current rates of production? And the answer to that is highly speculative, because the Saudis are not very transparent about their situation. There aren't any third party, U.S. Department of Energy or International Energy Agency, aren't any third parties that can go in and look and determine what the size of the reservoirs is and the state of depletion and so on. The evidence suggests that the Saudis are able to bump their production up a little bit from where it is right now. But whether they're going to be able to maintain that for more than a few months is a serious question.
Richard Heimberg is the author of 10 books, including the new one, The End of Growth, which we're talking about today. Previous titles, The Party's Over, Peak Everything, and Blackout. He is a senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and one of the world's leading speakers on peak oil, lecturer and educator on this subject. Al in Baltimore has a question for our guest, Richard Heimberg. Al, go right ahead.
Yes. My question is, we've been giving a lot of money, like subsidies, to oil companies. Do you think we should subsidize something else? I mean, apparently it does not seem to be working with getting efficiency out of the oil.
Right. Well, the oil companies are extremely profitable right now with very high oil prices, so they don't really need those subsidies currently. But, you know, we are going to need alternative energy sources as fossil fuels deplete and become more scarce and expensive. And unless we invest massively in those alternative sources of energy, they just won't be there. The reason I say that is that it takes a long time to transition the energy infrastructure of a modern industrial society. By some estimates, 3 or 4 decades is you know, about as fast as we could transition away from oil, coal, and natural gas. And I think we're going to need to do that at, you know, absolute maximum rate of speed, given the situation of depletion and also given the increasing environmental impacts as we move down the chain of lower and lower grade fossil fuels. You know, the environmental risks are increasing exponentially. So that means if we just wait for the market to take care of it, if we wait for solar to become cheaper than coal, if we just wait for electric cars to become cheaper and more convenient than gasoline-driven cars, we will have waited too long. And the market, you know, the market will solve the problem, but not in a way that we will like.
410-662-8780 is the number for Midday here out of WIPR Baltimore. Toll-free long distance, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. Maya is our next caller. Maya, thank you for calling Midday. You're on with Richard Heimberg.
Yes, I came into the show a little bit late, so I don't know if this is totally relevant, but what about measuring the growth of the economy based on the amount of leisure time we have and time to spend with friends and family instead of producing goods and building houses?
You know, I just want to say at this juncture, I'll let Richard comment on that, but before this show is out, I collected some items from your website, Richard, endofgrowth.org, some suggestions for what listeners can do in the face of all this, and we're gonna go over some of those before the hour's out. But your comment about how we measure quality of life, how we measure growth in this country.
Right. Well, I've just come back from a conference at the United Nations, a high-level meeting on well-being and happiness, defining a new economic paradigm. It was put on by the nation of Bhutan, which for the last 40 years has been measuring its progress with gross national happiness. And so they take into account things like leisure time, the quality of environment, and so on. And the result is, even though Bhutan it's a very small nation, has a pretty low GDP per capita, especially compared to a country like the United States, but the people of Bhutan are some of the happiest in the world. So this raises the question, you know, what is economic growth for? Is it just to make a few people who are already wealthy even wealthier, or is it to actually enable us to have a better time and enjoy our lives more? If the latter is the case, well, we're not doing a very good job actually, because social surveys of Americans show that we're really not any happier today than we were 40 years ago when the GDP was half of what it is now.
I should say, we're going to go over some of these a little bit later. There's some really interesting suggestions here. But generally what you're saying is you see the possibility of a new, smaller economy based on local and regional commerce, or even the possibility of local currencies. And you're saying, in your book, you're saying we can still thrive but we got to learn to do things more for ourselves and improve our communities here.
Right. Yeah. If it's going to be impossible for us to continue growing GDP and consumption, which I think it will be, then we have to find other things to aim for. It doesn't mean it's the end of the world. It doesn't mean it's the end of progress, of the betterment of human life and social well-being, unless we, you know, just fail to adapt properly to this historic moment. But there's every reason to think we can. We just have to start measuring other things and aiming to improve life in ways that really matter.
Here's a comment from Jim by email, and I'd like to get your response to this. He says, unfortunately, peak oil and limits to growth are so far off the political table that I have little hope for a political solution. I think everyone should prepare for a lower energy lifestyle, but I foresee a lot of ugliness in the future. One of the best things we can do is share the word, but few ears are receptive to this message. I'd like to hear your thoughts on possible strategies for coping with that.
Yeah, well, it's true. This is a very difficult message to get across. There's no politician out there who's saying, well, you know, if you vote for me, I promise to shrink the GDP.
Or I promise to I promise that you'll have pay more for energy and not have right. And we'll ration gasoline.
Right. Yeah. But the reality is that's the direction we're headed, and so this creates a disconnect, where you know we have a certain future that we are almost inevitably headed toward, and nobody in official places can talk about it. And I think a lot of Americans are sensing this gulf. It comes across in different ways, but we sense that our leaders are really not telling us what's actually going on. And that itself creates a kind of social malaise, if you will, where people are just less trustful of government. Somehow we have to get through this, and I don't have a magic bullet solution, but I think it's important that more and more of us start talking about this reality, start, you know, acknowledging, and I think young people are doing that to a much greater degree. I spend a lot of time with college students, and mm-hmm. I hear from them, you know, real concern that, you know, life as their parents and grandparents lived it, you know, the world of the 1960s and the Mad Men world of you know, rapid economic growth and bigger cars and bigger houses and all that. That's in the past. And they realize that their life is going to be different, and they want people to be talking about that.
Does anybody, I know that people disagree with you, or people, Richard, don't want to hear what you're saying, but does anybody disagree with that? I mean, maybe I just travel in a small circle or something, but I don't pal around with people who think, you know, the Ford Excursion's going to come back anytime soon, or that should be part of our economy. Most people I know are thinking smaller, thinking in terms of a smaller, slower future. I don't think anyone wants to be poor, but I think the expectations are lower given all these things, climate change. The cost of fuel.
Right. And that is the healthy adaptation where people actually are pulling back on getting out of debt, starting to grow more food in their backyard gardens, sharing more with their neighbors. These things actually are healthy adaptations. Now, here's the paradox. If more and more people do these things, it actually causes the economy to grow less. And that's the perverse part of the perversity of GDP. Mm-hmm. In order to keep the economy growing, we actually have to do things that are bad for us, go into debt more, consume more, and buy bigger houses and cars than we really need. So we've reached the end of that perverse line of growth and development that we were on for so many decades. And the adaptation is going to be complex, because it's not just a matter of changing our personal behavior. We have to change the economic system, too, so that it can continue to be healthy even as we do consume less.
It sounds like you want to take profits away. You want to close down Wall Street.
Well, you know, I think it's undeniably true that the financial aspect of the economy, the financial system, has grown too big as a segment of the economy. It's grown faster than manufacturing, grown faster than farming, or anything else you can name over the past 3 or 4 decades. And as a result, Wall Street has gained more political power. And I think we're living now with the results of that. We need to scale back the size of the financial industry. And it would be pretty easy to make that happen just by taxing financial transactions at a very, very low rate and then using the tax revenues to offset declining income taxes.
You know, in reading your economic analysis, what you had to say about the ascendancy of the wealthy, the shrinking of the middle class, which we're all familiar with, this increasingly one-sided distribution of wealth. It sounded like a lot like the Occupy Wall Street movement. Of course, notice that your book was published before that actually all happened. But do you see the Occupy movement as a vindication of your prediction?
Oh, well, it might be going too far to call it a vindication, but I think the Occupy movement is an inevitable social phenomenon at this point in our history. And I see it as part of a global end-of-growth uprising. You know, what we saw in Tahrir Square in Egypt or in Tunisia and what we've been seeing more recently in Greece and Spain and Ireland. People are seeing that, you know, the bankers are being paid off while everyone else is being forced to pay the bills for this recent bout of unsustainable economic growth. And the unfairness of that is just, you know, unbearable. So, of course, people are turning out in the streets. And it's going to get worse until we wake up and change this unconscionable strategy of paying the bankers off first.
Richard, a call here before we take our next break. Doug in Harford County. Thanks for calling, Doug.
Hi. I wanted to find out more about your fundamental economic theories. In today's managed economy, the central bank wants to keep prices stable. So as a result, interest rates are always going up and down by a large amount. But there are some people who say that it's better and even more natural to have an economy where interest rates are pretty much always the same, but prices vary by quite a bit. And they say that that would prevent the creation of credit bubbles, which, of course, we know are a great risk that shows up every once in a while. I just wanted to know your fundamental take on that.
Right. Well, you know, as long as we have a banking system, we're probably going to have central banks. The question is, you know, are they going to operate on behalf of the banking industry, or are they going to operate on behalf of society as a whole? Hmm. And, you know, I'm sure if we had the officials from the Federal Reserve sitting in the room with us, they'd be assuring us that that the Fed operates on behalf of society as a whole. But really, if you look at it, all of these folks are from the banking industry and feel at home there, and are looking out for the banking industry first and foremost. So, you know, if interest rates were set not on behalf of Wall Street, but on behalf of the rest of us, if we allowed prices to function more transparently, would we be better off? I'm sure we would, but you know, there are probably more fundamental reforms that are going to be needed in our economic and financial system even than that. There's a whole question as to whether the creation of money should be basically a privatized enterprise. Right now, the creation of money is a function of the commercial banks. When you go into a bank and take out a loan for $10,000, the bank creates that money at that moment. And when you pay off the loan, the $10,000 disappears. It's kind of magic, you know. But, you know, should that basic function be a privatized function, or should it be a kind of public utility? Because as long as we have debt-based money and money fundamentally in control of private banks, that means that interest is kind of a wealth pump that is constantly causing wealth to pool up among those who, you know, run the system, the financial system. And that's exactly what we've been seeing with the increasing concentration of wealth among what the Occupy movement is famously called the 1%. Hmm.
Richard Heinberg, our guest in this hour of midday on WYPR, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. He argues that the global economy has reached a fundamental turning point, the end of growth. The Great Recession will not end in recovery, he says. Still, we can thrive in coming years if we abandon the futile pursuit of growth in consumption and aim instead for improvements in quality of life. We'll talk about that when we get back after this short break. You're welcome to join our conversation again. This is Live Talk Radio on WYPR, 410-662-8780. A short break. And welcome back to Midday. You can join us at 410-662-8780. Send us a tweet at MiddayWYPR or an email with a question or comment for our guest, Richard Heinberg, author of The End of Growth. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Let's go back to the phone lines for some questions for our guest. Ed in Cockeysville, thanks for calling Midday.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I have one quick question, and I guess maybe two questions. One, economists have studied steady-state economics since Adam Smith. And I'm wondering if your guest has any comment on what that means today. Or if he's familiar with any of that kind of analysis. The second, and Dan, I talked to you a couple months ago about a horrific truck accident that took my wife and injured my son.
Yes.
As a result of that settlement, we are building an accessible and sustainable house. And the energy modeling on the design of our house has it costing less than $1,000 a year to run the house.
Wow.
And that's doing green roof, doing solar panels, geothermal. A lot of it just has to do with the fact that the property has a perfect south exposure sitting on the side of a hill. And so if you orient the house properly, you can significantly reduce your energy.
Right. Well, thank you for calling, Ed. Let me get Richard's comments on that. He used the phrase steady state economy. He also used the word sustainable, which I really wanted to ask you about. But first, do you have a comment on that, Richard?
Right. There was an economist named Herman Daly who taught for many years at the University of Maryland and was also chief economist at the World Bank for a short time. Herman Daly has written quite extensively about the idea of a steady state economy, and he points out that many of the early economic thinkers around the time of Adam Smith really envisioned the economy as growing only up to a certain point and then leveling off and continuing to satisfy people's needs, but they did not foresee an economy that would continually grow and grow and grow till kingdom come. So Daly is a very important thinker along these lines. Many would say the maven or the leading light of a whole school of economics called ecological economics, which sees economics as being functionally part of a larger discipline. You know, economists like to think of the entire natural world as being just a subset of the human economy. It's just a pile of resources that we use to make stuff that eventually becomes waste. But ecological economists turn that around and they say, no, the human economy is really just a subset of the global ecosystem, and we have to have a functioning global ecosystem if we hope to have a functioning economy. So, yeah, the steady state economy is a very important concept.
And what about a sustainable economy, a sustainable society? What does that mean?
Yeah, you know, the word sustainable has been, I think, maybe overused in recent years and watered down to the point where When we say something sustainable, often we just mean, well, it's a slightly more eco-groovy version of what we were already doing anyway. But the real content of the word sustainable is it means it's something that can go on in perpetuity. Right now, there's very little that we're doing that can go on in perpetuity. Anything that we do that involves fossil fuels, for example, is almost by definition unsustainable in its current form. Growth is inherently unsustainable. I mean, you can do it for a while. We've been doing it for decades and decades, but you can't do it forever. You very quickly arrive at absurdities like the 9 billion ton hamster we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, you know, Richard, what was different about the crash of 2008? A lot of people are looking at this now. The news, as I said at the outset of the show, we have some good news. It sort of trickles out from day to day. Increased consumer spending, employment numbers going down, unemployment numbers going down. Although I saw Yahoo today announced a layoff of 2,000 people or something. But anyway, there's some good news here. So we seem to be telling ourselves that we're slowly coming out of this, even though the gasoline prices are high. If they continue to go up, some predict that we could see another recession. But what's different about this period that we just came through in the context of the end of growth?
Yeah. Well, first of all, is this really a recovery? If you look at where the new income is going, about 80% of it is going to the very, very high level earners. So almost none of the recovery is actually being felt by the middle class or the poor. Well, what's different about what happened in 2008 was it was an instance of reaching fundamental limits, limits to debt, limits to energy, and limits to the environment. We've seen, for example, up to 2008, for the previous 40 years, debt had been growing faster than GDP in every single year. So, you know, if debt is growing at about the same rate as GDP, then it's okay to increase consumer debt, government debt, and so on. But if debt is growing faster than GDP, that makes financial bubbles more or less inevitable, and it sets up an eventual crash, which is what we saw in 2008. And the credit bubble that we built up during those 40 years was the largest in all of human history, and it hasn't deflated yet. What happened then was that government and the Federal Reserve stepped in to become the borrower and spender of last resort in order to keep the economy from imploding. And that process is really still continuing with deficit spending on the part of government and the Federal Reserve still buying up something like 60% of new government debt, basically pumping new money into the economy. Once that stops, once the federal government reaches the limits of its ability to borrow and spend more, as a result of the bond markets hammering it and causing interest rates to increase, once the Federal Reserve stops being the borrower and spender of last resort, then we will see the final unraveling of this credit bubble that we've been building up now for decades. And it's not going to be pretty. I think it's really important that we understand that this is waiting in the wings and we're going to have to deal with it at some point in time, whether it's a year from now or 5 years or 10 years. I think it's probably more likely a year or two or three from now. And so we should, you know, as households and as a country, we should be acting accordingly and preparing ourselves for it.
Well, I think this is a good place for us to talk. I think it's important for us to talk with you about what the average person can do to prepare for this post-growth world that you describe here in pretty grim ways. And there isn't a handbook for post-growth survival, but you have some interesting suggestions here that I pulled off, like I said, I pulled off your website, and I wanted to talk about them. Here's one. I'm just going to throw these at you, Richard, and then let you elaborate a little bit in the time that Sure. we have remaining together, okay? I was interested in this one. The question, where should I live? You say, I advise most people to stay where they are. Your greatest asset is your social capital, friends, families, neighbors. If you have little social capital where you reside now, then moving makes more sense. But otherwise, you say, say where you are. Just talk about that a little bit.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there are some parts of the country that I think, for ecological reasons having to do with water and climate, really are not good places to stay. And you know, if we were having this discussion in Tucson, Arizona, or Southern California, my comments would be different. But for people in most other areas, your survival is going to be linked to the survival of your community, the people around you, your neighbors and friends and relatives. That's your real community, and it's the core of your survival strategy. So it really doesn't make sense to think about moving someplace that might have better water or more opportunities for gardening or something like that, if you're going to be moving to a place where you don't know anyone.
This is going to sound like a downer to most people, but I think there's something in here that for you to elaborate on. I think this is important. You say focus on a series of relevant words that aren't especially cheery. Think of less, slower, smaller, and the hardest one, poorer. Would you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, right. Well, that's where we're going. That is in our inevitable future. So let's welcome it and get used to it. In most societies up until the last couple of hundred years, voluntary poverty was something that was respected, and a large segment of society, whether it was monks and nuns or spiritual folks of various stripes, would take on voluntary poverty as a way of life, and it was respected. We've kind of let that go today. If you voluntarily consume less than other people, you're looked at it kind of strangely, But I think it's actually a very good strategy for pre-adapting to the conditions that are on the way. For example, something my wife and I do a couple of times every year is go on an energy fast. Actually turn off the lights and the heat and don't drive for at least 24 hours and get used to the way that feels and notice how addicted we are to energy and notice, what the trade-offs are. Actually, when we do these energy fasts, we find ourselves often enjoying ourselves much more, enjoying our conversation, and noticing the natural patterns of dawn and dusk and so on.
We had some storms here in September, wasn't it? August to September, and people were without power for several days, some for too long. But I think a lot of people went through that. They were forced into it during those storms last year, Richard. It's interesting.
Yeah, and when the power goes out, people tend to get out of their houses and go knock
see their
on
neighbors.
Each other's doors and talk.
Hey, this is a real quick question from Charles, who says he's in his late 20s, and you're going to have to answer this in a minute or less, Mr. Heinberg. But he wants your advice for individuals to be successful in this future society. Are there any areas where we should focus our education and direct our careers?
Yeah, I think for most people, learning practical skills is going to be really, really important. Knowing how to grow food, knowing how to make things, and knowing how to fix the things we already have.
I like that.
Then for some young folks, I think it's important to get advanced degrees in learning how to transition the bigger systems of our society, the financial system, the energy system, and so on. And that takes specialized knowledge.
The End of Growth is Richard Heinberg's book, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. The publisher is New Society. Richard, thanks again for being with us on Midday. I appreciate what you had to say. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. That's our Midday for today. We'll take a break and come back in 22 hours and have another show for you at noon here on WYPR. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'll see you again tomorrow.